Well, so good yesterday to have Dr. Vincent and Dr. Minnick with us for the day, ministering to us, both the general sessions and the workshop sessions. And so glad to have Pastor Vincent preach for us tonight in our evening service. I mentioned yesterday this, but Dr. Vincent began ministering at Mount Calvary Baptist Church as one of the assistant pastors in 1999 and serves as over discipleship and other ministries as well. For me, I've gotten to know him more through online avenues as he has been my teacher for a couple of classes as, for my ongoing education. And I really appreciated the gracious words that he speaks even as he teaches. His breadth of knowledge of church history and the Word of God is remarkable. And I was really struck with that, and taking the courses, learned much from them. I can't remember if my grade showed that or not, but hopefully he forgot that as well. But really have appreciated his ministry of the Word. I've listened to other messages that he's preached online, and my heart has been blessed and warmed just listening to him. And I'm so thankful that he can be here with us tonight to preach the Word. As he comes, our men are going to come with the closing hymn that is actually a text that Dr. Vincent has written. And so hang on to that until the end of the message. But we wanted to get that passed out as he comes at this time to preach the Word.
Well, it is very, very kind of your pastor to share his pulpit. It really, during your testimony time, I felt the urge to speak. And just to thank you for the joyful way that you served. I don't know if anyone may have pointed this passage out to you before, but maybe it'd be one you can keep in mind year by year as you host this kind of conference and are a blessing to so many different people who come in. But in 1 Kings chapter 10, that's when the Queen of Sheba comes to visit Solomon. And, of course, she was overwhelmed by his wisdom. But the passage goes on that says, when she perceived all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his servants, the attendance of his waiters and their attire, his cupbearers, and his stairway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. So she came and she observed Solomon's household, and it just overpowered her. And I think that would be the testimony of those of us who came and observed your ministry to us yesterday. Everything was in order. Your countenances were joyful, and you thought of everything, and we were overwhelmed, I think, overcome. So thank you so much for your ministry and the spirit of it. And I know it's an extension of the burden and vision that your pastor has ministered to you. And we go home the richer for having been with you. And so thank you very, very much. I do want to ask you tonight to turn to John chapter 14. And while you're turning there, maybe I'll just recount a story for you from my childhood that's somewhat embarrassing. I grew up in the home of a Marine, and so we had the privilege of moving around a good bit, but I would not trade that life for anything. There were some wonderful experiences, and one of those experiences was that on one of the military bases where we lived, we had the benefit of a bookmobile that would come by and park outside of our next door neighbor's home about every 2 weeks. And I remember as a 5, 6, and 7-year-old boy while we lived at that house, looking forward to those visits from the bookmobile. And you would go out there with your friends and you would browse through the books, and being, you know, military brats, we liked the books on war. And on one particular occasion, I went out there with a buddy of mine who, as I recall, was just a little bit younger than me. And, you know, being there and being a little bit older than your friend, you feel somewhat distinguished and very mature. And he pulled a book off the shelf and he held it up to me and wanted me to read the title. He wasn't quite sure how to pronounce the words. And so when he held it up, I said, "Oh, that's Guadalcanal Island." And he was satisfied with that, which if I answer a question, wouldn't you be? And well, unbeknownst to me, to my right was an older boy, older than myself and obviously more intelligent than I was. And he had overheard our conversation and he said, "Oh, no, 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 that's Guadalcanal Island." Well, how would you respond in that moment if you were me? I wasn't real happy that he had interfered and shown me up. And so the only thing I knew to do was sort of to stand my ground and turn and face him and say, "No, it isn't." That's what my mom used to call hard-headedness. And that was a word she used frequently to describe me growing up. And there were times I actually thought that was my nickname. And there was one day I actually tried using that word on my mom. And I realized then it was not a term of endearment. And I never made that mistake again. But you know what hard-headedness is. Kind of an obtuseness. An unwillingness to learn or to yield. And so often throughout the Gospels, we see that spirit manifested in none other than Jesus' disciples. It's that time when you want to appear to know more than you do, or you want to at least appear sometimes to know even more than the person instructing you. And in the disciples' case, we know that they had given up so much to follow the Lord. They truly loved him, and they were willing to forsake all to follow him. They had left houses and lands. But yet, as they followed him, they were not always immediately responsive to his teaching. And at times when he rebuked and corrected them, they were still slow to learn. And there were times that Jesus had to actually address them about this very issue. He would be teaching them something important, like it's not what goes into a man that defiles him, but what comes out of a man that defiles him. And the disciples were having a hard time getting that point. And Jesus would have to then lovingly continue to teach and address them with questions that would continue to probe them, asking things like, "Are you lacking in understanding?" Sometimes he would do miracles like the feeding of the 5,000 or the feeding of the 4,000. And to us, it seems maybe that the point of all of that is so obvious. But for the disciples, they weren't entirely sure all that Jesus was teaching by those miracles. And in the aftermath of that, Jesus had to ask them some very pointed questions. He would ask them, "Do you not yet see or understand? Do you have a hardened heart?" It wasn't entirely an intellectual matter. The heart was connected to their dullness or to their hard-headedness. He would go on and say, "Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember?" Again, lovingly taking the opportunity of their hard-headedness to continue to instruct them. And at one point in the Gospel of Mark, it's actually explicitly stated for us that the disciples were not perceiving. In Mark chapter 6 and verse 52, they had not gained any insight, it says, because their heart was hardened. It really was, at the root, a heart issue for the disciples. And you know that sometimes they believe that they really understood things better than Jesus did. So much so that when he began to teach them, for the first time that he must go to Jerusalem and die and be buried and rise again the third day, Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him because Peter felt like he knew better. And the Lord in that instance had to firmly rebuke Peter and talk to him in very strong terms. Get behind me, Satan. Peter was savoring the things that be of men, not the things that be of God. All through Jesus' ministry, he is ministering to his disciples. He is bringing them along and teaching them. And in the passage that's before us here, there are two additional illustrations of this kind of hardness or dullness in the disciples' thinking. If you look at verse 8, after Jesus had been teaching his disciples here, and he's teaching them powerful truth. He is the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through him. And then Philip asks this question or makes this request, Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us. Seems like an intelligent statement or observation, but Jesus again corrects. And he says to Philip, have I been so long with you, yet you have not come to know me, Philip? And there's another illustration of that down in verse 22. The other Judas, the only one now left, the other has already left the room at this moment. But Jesus was teaching and Jesus taught something unexpected about disclosing himself only to his own people and not to the world. And that surprised Judas. And so he says, now what has happened then that you are going to disclose yourself to us and not to the world? And I should add that I'm reading from the New American Standard, so it may vary a little bit from what you have in your lab. But this ongoing need in the hearts of the disciples, Jesus did not back away from it, and he did not badger the disciples when it would display itself, but he would take it as an opportunity to continue to lovingly instruct them. And what I'd like us to do here this evening is to really ponder the disciples in the situation in which we find them here in this chapter. And I want us to try to put ourselves into their shoes. They have been following Jesus for 3.5 years, and now they come to the very last day, the last night of his ministry before the cross. And Jesus has introduced something to them that is extremely sobering. He has told them that he is going to go away. He's mentioned this multiple times, and he's told them that where he's going, they are not able to follow him. Now ponder for a moment that you had forsaken everything to follow Jesus. You had expectations that he was going to usher in the kingdom, that following him was going to be grand and glorious. And now he tells you in a very sober way that he's going to go away. And you are not able to follow him. This news, no doubt, humbled the disciples. They were distraught. That's why Jesus speaks to them the way he does in the opening verse of this chapter. Let not your heart be troubled. Because they were weighed down and distraught by this news. And again, put yourself in their shoes. How would you respond to the news that seemed to you to suggest that you were going to have to do without Christ? What would that do to you? If you received the news that Christ was going to depart from your life, what impact would that have? The one who had taught them and walked with them and helped them, had rebuked them, corrected them, and now he's going away. That's the situation in which the disciples find themselves. They had, throughout their time of following the Lord, had a difficult time fully comprehending the breadth and depth of his message. And in particular, as he would teach them about his own ministry, when they wanted glory And he was teaching them, even for himself, suffering must come first. That was not news they wanted to hear. And now on this night, it was the night when the suffering would very visibly begin. And what the disciples were going to find is what Jesus had already taught them. That following Christ was going to be a life not only of a cross for Christ, it was going to be a cross for them. They too were going to have to take up a cross, Jesus taught them, every day, and deny themselves and follow after Christ. That was a hard message for them to understand. But yet on this night, Jesus continues to echo that theme to his disciples and impress it upon them. Now, as the disciples manifest this hardness of heart, let's not forget that they did love him. And Jesus knew that. One modern day commentator, J.I. Packer, who some of you may be familiar with, he said of the disciples throughout their ministry, but think of it in connection with this particular scene, he says their understanding of spiritual things was faulty. And we understand and acknowledge that. Their misunderstandings of Jesus were frequent, and we observe that. Yet Jesus was able to touch and transform their lives beyond the limits of what had entered into their minds, simply because they loved him, trusted him, wanted to learn from him, and honestly meant to obey him according to the light that they had. The disciples, dull of heart though they may be, here on this night, they find themselves in the best place of all. They are still sitting at the feet of Jesus, and they are listening to the words that fall from his mouth. And the words that fall from Jesus' mouth in this chapter and the chapters that follow in this upper room discourse are reassuring words. And the way that Jesus goes about reassuring his disciples is a way that probably surprises us. He actually brings all three members of the Godhead, as it were, into the conversation. And he teaches them some things that he had taught them before. He brings those back up and reinforces them. And then he also teaches them some new things on this occasion. New things that they would not fully comprehend now, but that after he had been resurrected, they would begin to understand. And they would be thankful that he had taught them that even before he had gone to the cross. If you look at verse 15 of John chapter 14, we're going to read just a couple of verses here, and it'll set the context for us. Jesus has ministered many reassuring things to them in the first 14 verses. But in verse 15, he begins a new paragraph of thought. He says, "If you love me," and now the modern translations will read like I'll read it here, "you will keep my commandments." Okay, I'll say more about that in just a moment. In verse 16, he goes on, he says, "I will ask the Father, and he will give you another helper that he may be with you forever." And that's as far as we'll read here at the moment. And what I'd like to emphasize in the time that we have tonight are divine assurances for our reassurance. Divine assurances for our reassurance. And as we step into this passage, I think it's helpful for us to acknowledge that we are stepping into a stream of living water. These are living waters flowing out of the mouth of Christ. And we're not stepping into a shallow portion. We're stepping into a wide, fast-flowing, deep section of the living water. And hopefully it'll be as refreshing for us as Jesus intended it to be, reassuring for his disciples on that occasion. Now, as we look at verse 15, what I want us to do is try to break that particular verse down into some of its parts. Look at it again. It says, if you love me, now the King James reads, keep my commandments. We'll spend just a moment with this so that we can kind of carry this thought forward throughout the rest of the message. Keep, if you say, if you love me, keep my commandments. That's an imperative. It sounds like a command. Like, if you love me, keep. Okay, like it's an order. And it's very possible to translate this verb that way. But the word, as it appears in the New Testament text, can also be translated in a future sense. The exact same form of the word can either be an imperative or it can also be a future tense verb. So either keep or you will keep. And what I'd like to suggest, and feel free if it helps you to make a marginal note about this possibility, that other way to translate the word is a very helpful way to translate it, because it actually helps to bring out the sense of what Jesus is saying to his disciples. Now, in breaking this down, we'll refer to that again in a little bit. We'll come back to that thought, but it'll help, I think, here at the outset to just try to have that to be clear. Now, if you love me, you will keep my commands. Okay, what is Jesus saying to his disciples in this moment that is really reassuring to them? We know that Jesus has taught his disciples about loving God. We know that he's taught them about loving their enemies. And we know that he's taught them about loving each other, loving their neighbor as themselves. But this is the first time in the Gospels that Jesus is going to give any attention to the theme of loving him. And this is the passage where he spends more time doing that than any other passage. So this is a critical passage on love for Christ. If you look at verse 15, you have that expression, love me. If you look down at verse 21, he who has my commandments and keeps them, he it is that loveth me. And then in the second part of the verse, and he who loves me. So you see it twice in verse 21. You see it again in verse 23. You're going to see the negative of it in verse 24. And then again, at the very end of verse 28, or right in the middle, if you loved me. Okay, so this whole section is going to emphasize this particular theme, and it's going to do so uniquely in all of Jesus' teaching as he introduces his disciples to this theme of their love for him. Now, the way that this is set up, the particular paragraph that we're looking at, look again at verse 15. He says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Okay, so love is the spring out of which the keeping of the commandments comes. You see that? Look down at verse 21. He who has my commandments and keeps them, he it is who loves me. You see how it's backwards there? Love there is the fruit of obedience. Those two verses are the bookends of this particular paragraph. The beginning, love is the spring of obedience. And on the back end, love is the fruit of obedience. It captures both aspects of it. And again, I just want to emphasize that when Jesus is teaching in this unique way about loving him, he's not doing it in a very tight passage that doesn't talk about anything else. Jesus is teaching about loving him in a passage, in a paragraph, where he's going to talk about the Father. He's also going to talk about the Holy Spirit. The other members of the Godhead are going to be woven all through this teaching. And it'll be helpful for us to keep that in mind. Now, a second observation about verse 15 that I think will be helpful for us. Jesus says, if you love me, you will keep my commands or commandments. Now, notice how Jesus equates himself with his words. If you love me, you will keep the commands that are mine. Hey, think about what that's saying about the authority of the one who gave those commands. Jesus is inseparably attaching himself to his words. His words have all the authority of the person. Now, in following Christ, we might want to think that, well, you know, I can decide what it means to follow Christ. I'll follow him in the way that pleases me. Well, this passage doesn't give you all of that wiggle room. Jesus inseparably attaches his words to himself. When he came and ministered, the Gospel of John tells us he was full of grace and truth. And that as he ministered, it was grace upon grace. And his ministry of grace upon grace involved commands. And Jesus is the one who says, love for me involves great attention to my commands. Love for me recognizes my authority in my words. That's grace. Grace is not able to be separated from Jesus' authority and Jesus' commands. Another observation that we could make here is just the importance that Jesus is placing on love or a loving obedience. Okay, it's Jesus who elevates obedience to this premier expression of love for him. If you love me, you will keep, another way to translate that would be to obey my commands. Jesus himself is identifying that display of love. Obedience is something Jesus loves to see. And he's telling his disciples that he's going to be going away, but he's still going to be able to see their obedience. Think of that. Jesus is going to go away. He's going to ascend into heaven. And even from there at the right hand of the Father, when his children love him and show it by obedience, he sees it. And he's letting them know, this is important to me. Your love expressed through obedience is something that I could see. And even though you're on earth and I'm in heaven, it still penetrates all the way to my heart. Okay. Obedience is important to Jesus. He loves it when he sees it. Now, one other observation, and this gets back to the way that the particular verse is translated. When Jesus says to his disciples, if you love me, you will keep my commands. Jesus is not giving a command to sort of put the disciples in fear. The whole passage is Jesus ministering to them reassuringly. In the chapter before, he actually calls them little children. In the chapter that comes after, he's going to tell them, you are no longer servants, but friends. There's no question in Jesus' mind that his disciples love him. But he's showing them his own belief, his own certainty, that what he knows about them enables him to anticipate the fruit of their love. Imagine Jesus saying these words to you. If you love me, you will keep my commands. We may be fearful, we may be uncertain, and yet Jesus ministers reassuringly, if you love me, you'll keep my commands. Now think of the ones to whom he's ministering this. That night, every one of them were going to fall. All the disciples would forsake him. Peter, the leader of the disciples, was going to capitulate and deny the Lord. But even to these men, the Lord could minister reassuringly, that is not your ultimate destiny. You may fall, but you will not stay down. You will keep my commands. And it's because the Lord knew something that these men did not yet know. Jesus knew that he was to be the firstborn among many brethren made like unto himself. These very men to whom he was speaking were going to be transformed into his image. Jesus knew about these men when he prayed in John chapter 17 and verse 17, that they were going to be sanctified by the truth. He knew that these men were to be given through his cross work. They were to be given everything that they needed for life and godliness, that the good work that the Father had begun in them would be completed. Jesus knew that, and he could minister to them reassuringly, if you love me, you will keep my commands. Now, as God's children, we know, and so often, we are so aware of our failures. And we could be so discouraged at our frequent failings. But even though that is the case, if we were to look at ourselves, if we are true believers, like the Lord looked at his disciples on this night, okay, the Lord knows that if we belong to him, if we love him, we will keep his commands. That's what people who belong to him do. He repeats that over and over, or he does not, but his disciples repeat that over and over again throughout the epistles. This is how the children of God distinguish themselves. They love, and they keep, and they obey. In your own heart, those times when you are discouraged at your weakness, or at your failures, know what the Lord is looking for in your heart is a heart of love. A heart of love that's willing to get up, to confess the wrong. And just like when the Lord then comes to Peter after Peter fell, the Lord's restoring Peter. And he says to Peter, Peter, do you love me? Three times over, he asks that question. And then he entrusts Peter with the task of obeying him. Peter, feed my sheep. The Lord ministers reassuringly to those who are his children. Now, what Jesus knows about his disciples, what he knows about what's going to be theirs because of the cross, is what enables him then to minister these assurances to them. And what he's about to say in verse 16 is another reason Jesus is able to minister to them so reassuringly. And where verse 16 goes is not something that eye has ever seen or ear has ever heard, nor has entered into the heart of man. We could not have devised what we're about to read. It is beyond our comprehension. We could not have made this up. But Jesus ministers so reassuringly to his disciples because now he tells them, I'm going to pray something regarding you. I'm going to express my will to the Father that he send you another comforter. The modern translations tend to say another helper. Okay, we'll say more about that in just a moment. That he may abide with you forever. Because Jesus knows he's going to express that wish to the Father and the Father is going to answer it, he's able to minister reassuringly to his disciples. Now, let's just get inside verse 16 for a minute. And we'll have to do this very fast. Our time is almost up. Okay. But when Jesus tells his disciples that he's going to pray that the Father would send to them or give them a gift from heaven who would be another comforter, the word that he uses there is the word parakletos. Can I mention that word not to be technical, But just so we can kind of break it into its parts and recognize that what Jesus is saying is, I'm going to pray and the Father is going to send a comforter or a helper. And this is one who parakletos, he comes alongside. Okay, the nature of his ministry is going to be to come alongside. And translators have wrestled with this word down through the centuries. And in English, it's been translated counselor, helper. In 1 John chapter 2 and verse 1, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. Advocate is this word. And the idea, and that's referring to Christ. And even in the word comfort, okay, it's not that his ministry is going to be a soothing ministry. The idea that he's going to come and he's going to give strength. It's going to come fortify. You could almost translate comfort that way. Okay, that's the nature of the ministry, that Jesus is going to pray that the Father would send another comforter to have with his disciples. But there's another word in the verse that's very helpful, and it's the word another. Jesus had two options here. He could have used a word for another that conveyed another of a different kind. But he chose a word that means another of the same kind. Okay, now think of that. I'm going to express a wish to the Father that he sends you another comforter. A comforter of the same kind. Same kind as who? Same kind as Christ himself. Christ had been with his disciples. Christ had taught his disciples. He had rebuked and corrected and ministered conviction to his disciples. In so many ways, not in every way, but in so many ways, the ministry of this other third person of the Godhead was going to be very much in the same character as the ministry of Christ had been to his disciples when they were here on earth. It's as if what Jesus is saying to his disciples is, I'm going to express my wish that the Father sends you another helper, another comforter. And that comforter, if you want to know what he's like, look at me. I'm the prototype for what this comforter's ministry is going to be to you. In fact, he's so much like me, he's going to love my words. And it's my words that he's going to bring back to your remembrance and help you to understand. If you go down to verse 17, there's another reference here that helps us understand who this third person of the Godhead is. He's called the Spirit of Truth. And there are two aspects there. Okay, we understand that this third person, he'll be different than Christ in that he is a spirit, and he's a spirit of truth. This member of the Godhead had ministered truth to the people of God since all the way back at the very beginning of our Bibles. And Jesus is reassuring his disciples that now he will minister truth to you. He will be a source of truth for you. He's going to bring back to your remembrance. Not only will he be a source of truth for you, but he's going to help you remember truth. And he's going to help you perceive truth, understand what it means. And he's going to help you apply truth. This is a spirit of truth. He will be true to the character of his ministry, and he will be true to what Jesus requests, that he will be with his disciples forever. Now, there are ongoing assurances that fill out this chapter and chapter 15 and chapter 16. And we won't tonight try to take time to go into those. But if you'll indulge me for just a moment, let's just read through the remainder of these verses. In verse 17, this one that Jesus is requesting is the Spirit of Truth, whom the world cannot receive because it does not see him or know him. But you know him because he abides with you and in you. Okay, now think of that. The nature of the ministry of this third person of the Godhead is not just come alongside, it's not just with. Jesus says it's going to be in you. Now, we can't feel this. We can't see it. We just have to believe what Jesus says. When he tells us this is what he's praying, and God answers that prayer, we must live in the belief that that is so. A member of the Godhead dwells inside you. If you know the Lord, as you sit here tonight, you are not alone. You have a member of the Godhead alongside you, with you, and in you. Verse 18, Jesus says, I will not leave you as orphans. Nothing that is about to happen is going to disrupt your relationship to my Father. In fact, everything that's going to unfold in the coming days is only going to enhance your relationship to my Father. And let's get down, if you will, to verse 21 for sake of time. And Jesus says to his disciples, he who has my commandments and keeps them is the one who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and will disclose or manifest myself to him. Okay, listen to this other reassurance Jesus is giving to the disciples. They are going to still, though he ascends, they are still going to be able to fellowship with him, with a resurrected living Christ. And though he's gone, he's going to be able to keep doing what he's been doing during the whole 3 to 3.5 years that they've been with him. He's going to keep teaching them about himself. He's going to keep unfolding who he is to them. He's going to keep unfolding to them what it means for them to be in Christ, for them to follow Christ, for them to love Christ. Jesus is going to draw near to those who love him. His Father will love them. Jesus says, and I will continue to disclose myself to them. Now let's read verse 23. He says, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our abode with him. Okay, do you see what Jesus is saying? Earlier we saw that there's a member of the Godhead who comes alongside and is with and dwells in you. What Jesus is now teaching to his disciples is it's not just one member of the Godhead. There's a second member of the Godhead, the Father. And the Son himself makes their abode with one who loves Christ. As you sit here, if you are a believer, all three members of the Godhead dwell in your heart. Paul prays that we would comprehend that Christ dwells in our hearts by faith. That's a reality we cannot see with our physical eyes. We cannot touch with our physical hands. But we can appropriate that reality by faith. Now, Jesus is attempting, and you can see the whole tone of this. He's ministering reassuringly to his disciples. He's providing for their needs, not only in this moment, but for all times. For the remainder of their days, all three members of the Godhead would minister in them and strengthen them and love them and disclose themselves to them. This is the reassurance for everyone who belongs to Christ. And if you're here tonight, maybe you need this reminder. When you go to work tomorrow and you're battling against a coworker and you feel like you're all alone or the odds are overwhelming and that you have to fall, Maybe it'll help you to remember that, no, I'm not alone. And in fact, the ones who are with me are far stronger than I am. And with God the Father and God the Son and God's Spirit dwelling in me, I am more than conqueror through Him who loved me so. I am not alone in the battle. The entirety of the Godhead stands with me. If you're a Christian, when you get Christ, think of this. You get everything that comes with Him. You get His Father. You get His Spirit. You get His Word. You get His position. You get His people. You get His power. You get everything that comes with Christ. Those indeed are unsearchable riches. And that is all yours by faith to make use of, to appropriate, to apply. This evening, I'd like to conclude our time, if we can, by singing together the hymn that has been distributed for you. And this is just a meager effort to try to put some of the thoughts from this passage into a form that was helpful for me. Something portable that I could carry around with me to remind me at least of some of the reassuring truths that a passage like this communicates to us. If you'll notice the opening phrase, it starts with a question. You remember when Paul met the Lord on the road to Damascus, he cried out, "Who are you, Lord?" Okay, and that's what the opening line is referring to. Now think of Paul. He cries that out as he's thrown to the ground. And then from that impoverished state, Paul the Apostle begins to grow. And we know the story and trajectory of his life, in grace enriched by love to know, as Christ drew near himself to show. Now Paul, throughout his writings, exhorts us to be like him, to follow Christ like he follows Christ. And this song hopefully will help us in that direction. Pastor Tegan, can you come and lead us in this?